Wednesday, September 7th, was an A-plus day in the White House, full of activity and, I thought, of achievement. Clinton had asked Max Brooks and Roy White and Bill Heath and Dr. Grover and Gordon Bunshaft to come for breakfast at 9 to talk about the LBJ Library. Between telephone and staff, he was tied up. I took them in for a breakfast of poached and scrambled eggs and bacon and sausage and toast. He joined us after a while, and the conversation centered on the stone material for the library. Texas shellstone is too soft to use for flooring, and Bunshaft has considerable hesitance about using it. We all agree that there should be a tannish beige material, because that is the overall color of the campus. He has heard of a soft beige granite from a New Mexico quarry that he wants to look into. He spoke of the material in the Freer Gallery. We all piled into Lyndon's car, 9 of us, because with Lyndon, only a minute lapses between the suggestion and the act, and walked up and down in front of the gallery, to the concern of the guard, I think, who didn't know what would be happening next. It's a handsome old building of another day, rather classic. I like the material well enough. I'm sorry to say goodbye to shellstone if we do, although there's always a chance that it won't weather well. Some buildings have streaked and turned gray. I am unsure about the basic concept of the library. That great monolithic wall with no windows worries me, like a face without eyes. But I like the play of shadows from the design around the top, and the band of light will make it look like it's floating at night, and the terrace all across the south wall. He has taken away the ramp, and that is an improvement. I like the long building that houses the 3 units, the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Service, the archives of the university, and the Latin American collection. It makes quite a magnificent complex, joined to the main university by a handsome mall. The simple fact is, I have no qualifications to judge a building of this character that must last for the ages, and I carry my responsibilities uneasily. And I know we should have had an exhibit man and a writer who had really lived inside Lyndon's skin to pluck out from his 32 or 3 years in public life the important nuggets, and then to show them in graphic, interesting, dramatic fashion. Well, to find 2 such people is the job that faces us. I said goodbye to the library group a little past 10 and went for that 4-hour ritual of getting a permanent, having a hamburger in the chair, and then about 2:30 back upstairs to sign mail, talk with Bess, down to the East Room and meet the 5 young winners who are there rehearsing, and then on to the theater for an hour of looking at Tom Atkins' wedding pictures. They are splendid. It's been a Herculean job of editing. You could practically wrap up the Capitol Dome in the footage. Delightful music ties it together, and there's a script that has a bit of poetry and sentiment, and is quite well done, I think. It will have to be watched carefully. I had to tell Tommy that I must read it all and edit it. I could see that it made him nervous, because he's got a deadline for finishing the whole thing, and this pushes him. I, too, feel pushed and harried between reading Jim Bishop's book for any inaccuracies about me, and the script for the Living White House, and the script for this movie, and the 5 or so speeches involved in the trip to California, Arizona, and New Mexico. I feel that I'm carrying more than I can handle. But it's been a long, happy summer, and it's just time to get back to work. The next event on the day was Mrs. Longworth coming for tea. She and I have a date to have a picture made for the United Givers Fund, and that is somehow too bald, too unadorned by hospitality. So I asked her to come about 30 minutes early and have a cup of tea with me and a bit of talk. She brought me a book, Cowboys and Kings, letters written by her father to the famous men of his day, with a description from her saying that she expects the president will find some of the situations much the same today. She's getting her books in order, and she was talking about running into clippings about her own wedding, even old letters received decades ago and not opened. What an interesting job for somebody. She thought the wedding was marvelous and seems to really like both Linda and Lucy. Lyndon came in with a word of banter. She does, I'm sure, like him. I think it's because they're somewhat alike. They're both brave and tough. Presently, we went downstairs and sat side by side on a sofa in the library with a little boy of about 5 between us who was a symbol of what the United Givers Fund does to help children in need. She made his quiet little face light up by showing him a jewel she had on her shoulder, a beetle that turned out to be a watch when you flipped the catch and the beetle's wings flew up. It was a wedding gift from her mother, she said. I walked with her to the door and then returned to the China Room to meet the group from the Arthritis and Rheumatism Association and have my picture made with the little girl who is their poster child this year. Mm-hmm. And then upstairs for just a little bit of rest. How weary I find myself after a day of merely thinking and meeting people. But there were only about 30 minutes to rest before time to dress for the big event of the day. It was a reception in honor of the winners of the Tchaikovsky competition. While I was putting on my red lace, Lyndon called and said, "What's this about me supposed to make a speech to introduce them? Nobody ever told me. I'm so tired, I don't think I can do it. Won't you do it?" My heart sank. He said, "I've got this in front of me, what I'm supposed to say." I said, "How about reading it to me?" He did, and the words were wonderful. So very right for the president to say, so impossible for me to say. I urged him to go on and do it, feeling cruel with every word I said. A few times here in the White House, there's been an entertainment that I've been very proud of, that I think is just right. Tonight was one of those. Okay. Dorothy McArdle called it one of the most artistically brilliant evenings ever held at the White House. And Paul Hume said, "Not since the memorable night when Pablo Casals played there have so many of this country's distinguished musicians come together in that historic room." The guests were all seated in the East Room by 7:10, and I was waiting anxiously for Lyndon. He came swinging along, his fatigue hidden. I went straight to a seat in the front row, and he to the podium. And here was a single flaw of the evening. No spotlight came on him. In complete darkness, he spoke, quietly and in his warmest vein, welcoming the young winners of the Tchaikovsky competition. I relaxed when he said Tchaikovsky right, he'd ask me how, saying to them that they were indeed a national treasure, that they wore the brightest badge of all, the pride and admiration of your countrymen. You have achieved much in the country with which we have many differences by lifting their thoughts from those things that make us adversaries to things that make us brothers. And then there was the performance. Van Cliburn was master of ceremonies. Eric Leinsdorf was sort of the shepherd in charge of all the young winners, and invaluable to us. I had called him myself when we first began to plan it. In fact, I had worked more on this than on most of our entertainments. The first winner was a bass baritone, Simon Estes, a tall, handsome Negro, who sang an aria from Eugene Onegin in Russian, and then a spiritual, "Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child." And next, a cellist, Stephen Cates. His instrument is one I know least in all the field. But his second piece, Capriccio, was a delightful piece of showmanship. You didn't have to know anything about a cello to like it. I liked it for his acting. And then another Negro, Veronica Tyler, elegantly gowned, beautiful, who sang a piece from Puccini. And then another spiritual. He's got the whole world in his hands. The fourth winner was Misha Dichter, a pianist, who, according to Time, the Russian people had preferred to the one who won first place. And his Russian dance by Stravinsky made the walls rock. He had a pixie look and great showmanship. In fact, they were all actors as well as musicians. And then a little flurry passed through the room when, for Veronica Tyler, Eric Leinsdorf had come to the piano to accompany her. I was absolutely delighted to see that Lyndon was apparently enjoying it. He was clapping heartily for everyone. They could practically all have come back for an encore if they had listened. And then it was time for the last, Jane Marsh, the first prize winner, a soprano, the second American to take the highest laurels in the Tchaikovsky competition. Van Cliburn, of course, had been the first. She sang three numbers, none of which were familiar to me. Ain't It a Pretty Night, great vehicle for her voice and for her acting, and then a Tchaikovsky lullaby. And then an absolutely wild thing from Puccini. I asked her about it later, and she said the young girl has just been deeply hurt by her lover, and she is going to commit suicide. I had seen tears and rage and pain gather on her face. She's really a marvelous actress. Then to thunderous applause, it was all over. I had worried lest it be too long. It was not one moment too long. I took Van Cliburn's arm, and Lyndon got Jane Marsh, and we went into the Blue Room, where the photographers were lined up for pictures of us, with the five winners who had performed, with all of the winners, with Eric and Van Cliburn, and then the receiving line. It was indeed a star-studded audience of some 240 musicians and lovers of music. All the parents of the 13 winners had been invited, and that was a happy note to me. Mr. Alexander Zinchuk, the minister counselor from the embassy of the USSR, had sat in the front row in the absence of the Dobrynins, who were in Moscow. Composers ranged from Richard Adler, our handsome young friend, who brought a pretty little blonde kitten of a girl, to the venerable Rudolf Frimmel. If I remember correctly, he goes as far back as Rose Marie. His presence caused a wave of excitement in the crowd. He looked rather like a gay little gnome. And there was Ferdy Grofe in his wheelchair, who had composed the music for the Salute to Congress. Pianists ranged from Rudolf Serkin to Victor Borgia, who'd brought a 2-foot wooden spoon as a gag gift, to Ralph Vatpeck. Among opera singers, there was Roberta Peters and Jerome Hines and Robert Merrill, Mildred Miller and Eileen Farrell, plump, hearty, radiating happiness, and Richard Tucker, and two who had sung at our inaugural, Todd Duncan and Theresa Coleman, who later was in happy conversation with Claudia Marsh. It was Charles who had helped to get through music school long ago. And there were friends with a musical bent, the Eugene Carusis and the Oscar Coxes, and the Richard Dietrichs, and the John Hayes, he'd just been appointed an ambassador. I was particularly delighted to have Jane McDonough, Mary Lasker's secretary, and her mother, who'd been our old friend from Lyndon's first days in Congress, 1937. And the critics were there, of course. Howard Taubman, Paul Hume, and the Winthrop Sargents from the New Yorker. There were conductors, Howard Mitchell of the National Symphony, Robert Whitney of the Louisville Orchestra, who had helped us out with the Festival of the Arts, and Ezra Rocklin of our own Austin Symphony, as well as the Fort Worth Symphony now. I was particularly delighted to have a moment with Gerald Wagner and talk about the honeymoon. He knew all about the nuns that Lucy had gone swimming and boating with, even added the detail that one of them always wore a bright red bathing suit. And we had invited those who'd given us the music for the wedding, Robert Twynham, the organist, and the head of the choir. And Bess, who's wonderful about remembering people, had asked the Harold Spivaks. She is the director of the University of Maryland Madrigal Singers, who gave us such delightful music at Christmas time, one of the happiest entertainments I remember. And Roy Meacham of the Post Newsweek stations, who's been so helpful in writing those introductions of artists for me. The Congress was rather sparsely represented with Claiborne Pell and Frank Thompson. And from the rest of government, there were Dr. and Mrs. Barnaby Keeney, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Roger Stevens, chairman of the Council on the Arts, and the Charles Frankels, he's Assistant Secretary of State for Educational and Cultural Affairs. They were directors of musical schools and festivals such as the James Keynes from Aspen, and the Walter Hendels of the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, Dr. Charles Kent of the Peabody Conservatory. There were others from the world of entertainment, Elia Kazan and the David Susskinds, the Peter Duchins who had played for us at the wedding, and the Lee Evans who'd played for us at that never-to-be-forgotten party for the Krogs. When the receiving line was over, I told Lyndon, who seemed to have gotten over being tired, and had hugged Eric Leinsdorf as he came down the line, and had also hugged John Steinbeck, that I was going in and visit, but he could go back to work. However, he went into the buffet and joined the most chattering throng I've practically ever heard there. It was a happy party. So many people knew each other or knew each other's work. There were reunions of singers and composers and conductors. Someone connected with the opera in San Francisco began at once to try to persuade me to stop there for their opening night. Everybody was ravenous. Lyndon stayed until nearly 10, and I stayed almost an hour afterward, talking with each of the winners and their families, basking in the glow of a really good party. The next day, a newspaper man said, "It was a heartwarming night for music, and the White House seemed wholly at ease as a background for the young musicians of the country." Nobody was prettier than Linda Bird, who in her short black floating chiffon cocktail dress, the black velvet dots, made every head turn. The last guest left about 11:15, and the curtain rang down on one of our best days.